You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. Today, we're going to look at an era of American politics that featured the following: extreme partisanship, voting against the other party in place of voting for your party, impeachment, presidents elected without winning the popular vote, passion, argument, and questions about the future of our democracy. Am I talking about today? No. You'll be surprised to hear I'm talking about a 50-year span in the late 1800s and early 1900s that's a subject of a book called The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. The author is with me today. He's John Grinspan, who's the curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Robin. I'm really happy to be here talking to you.
This book came out in 2021, and I just heard about it and read it, and I highly recommend it. But, you know, I think I'm like most people. You remember your American history in civics and history classes, and everybody jumps from the Civil War to the New Deal. And we miss this span, which, as the more I look at it, it was so important in our country's development. How did you come to look at this era and specifically kind of give us a background of what you found?
Well, I guess maybe it started because I'm a contrarian and, you know, everyone talking about the American Revolution and the Civil War and World War II start saying, well, what else happened in this country? Especially you look around the nation and you look at these institutions, and so many of them come from this period, from the Civil War to World War I, the buildings we have, the political and social organizations we have, all these structures come from this kind of historical flyover period that people don't know very well. And so if you just want to understand our country, it's to me the formative period, especially for listeners, places like Iowa and Illinois, but all over the country. This is the takeoff period. And then if you delve into the politics, just starting with the turnout rate, when this is a peak of turnout in American history, elections are never have a higher turnout of eligible voters than in the 1880s and 1870s. And we never talk about these elections. I just went down this rabbit hole. And the more I went, the more honestly frustrated I became when people would use words like unprecedented and kind of talk about our times as if everything had been smooth sailing up till 2016 or 2008 or whatever. So it really just made me want to show people this story that I think is, you know, some parts of it are scary and some parts of it are a little consoling. We've had crises of democracy in the past and we've actually muddled our way through. So it's not all the end of the world.
You start in 1865, right, after the Civil War, and that was, of course, the 64-60 elections were obviously very, very critical. But so we start here. You start here, and you talk about your book's divided in three sections: pure democracy. What is that, and how does that play a role in this first part of your era understudy?
Well, there's this idea coming. I guess you have to begin with the idea that, in a way, the Civil War is over democracy, that it is brought by Southern slave owners, this tiny minority, 400,000 people in a nation of tens of millions, who basically bring the Civil War to defend slavery, but also because they know they're being swamped out in a democracy. So the winning Union side sees it as a victory for democracy. And they see it as a victory for kind of common working class people who fought the war, for formerly enslaved people who also fought the war. And they talk about this new pure democracy where there won't be all these restrictions on who gets to vote, who gets to participate. And, you know, not everybody agreed. Most people still held a lot of, you know, frankly, bigoted views and we wouldn't call them progressives today, but they were thinking about their democracy in terms of how can it expand? How can we bring more people in? How can it be more on the ground, decided at the ballot box? And there are obviously, like I said, there are limitations on that. Women can't vote. People under 21 can't vote, although this is the era when the movement for women's suffrage kind of really gained steam. But this is this period when they're really experimenting. And people have a lot of faith in the idea that the ballot box can resolve questions. And we don't think of the Civil War era and Reconstruction as optimistic, but there are a lot of people who think this is a takeoff period for democracy.
These elections, as you talked about, are marked by some incredible turnout, which has always struck me. And if there's anything that this era is known as, it's the Gilded Age. But you make some really interesting points here that I think are worth talking about. One, how the Gilded Age, we tend to look at it in our looking back at history about economics. But you say, quote, we read history backwards sometimes. Can you kind of explain that and talk about what the Gilded Age was about?
Yeah, I mean, I think we know this in our own era, that periods that we are done with, we have a really tidy view of them, right? Like I always think of the view of the 1950s that you have from people who grew up in the 60s, from baby boomers who were kind of dismissive of the earlier culture of kind of post-war America. And no one thought, or few people thought that way in the 1950s. It's a later view looking back. It took people a really long time to start talking about income inequality in America, even though over the Gilded Age, it's growing and it's yawning and it's really a fundamental problem as it is today. A lot of people aren't talking about it at the time. It's the big problems in society. Often people can't express right when they're living through it. But the thing they're arguing about nonstop is politics, partisan politics. I mean, you might get kicked out of a saloon or a club or whatever if you try to talk about income inequality. But if you talk about the other political party and how you hate them and how you're going to beat them, that's entertainment. That's social life. That's these big campaigns are really the fundamental social life, especially in communities that are rural, that have smaller towns. The biggest group of people you're ever going to see is at a political rally right before an election or on election day. These are before football, before Hollywood. This was American popular culture in a way. So people are really talking politics a lot, and they're not talking about the haves and the have-nots until they finally are. There's a delay there.
And we have to remember that we didn't have social media, we didn't have television, and I think those are major factors where it was. We're just getting the railroad, Transcontinental Railroad, built, but political communications were more face to face and maybe through newspapers.
Yeah, and it's a big scary country. I mean, there are tons of immigrants coming in from Germany, from Scandinavia, from Ireland, from China, who don't have roots, don't have connections, don't have family or kin or folk traditions in a new land, but they're these political parties and they need your votes and they need your boots to march in parades and your liver to drink and your hands to throw bricks at the rivals. They need you. And that feels really meaningful in a society that is really shaken up.
As we move into the next section, and you tell this story as great historians do. I really enjoyed this part, and through the lives of a couple of people that, to be honest, I wasn't aware of. Could you talk about these folks a little bit and how their experiences fit into the themes of your book?
Well, Robin, I appreciate you saying that, because you write a book and you think you found some people who help you tell your story, and you just don't know, does this make any sense or not? But I wanted to tell the story of this long era, right? It starts with the Civil War and it goes all the way into the 20th century. And most people don't live and are politically active for that long. But there's this one family, the Kelly family, who just kept showing up everywhere I look for really almost a century, from the 1830s to the 1930s. Either there's Will Kelly, the dad, his real formal name is William Darrah Kelly Jr. People called him Pig Iron Kelly because he's kind of a campaign politician in Pennsylvania who's associated with the steel mills there and the iron mills. And his daughter, Florence Kelly, who's a progressive reformer going into the 20th century. And between these two people, you can tell a story that goes from Andrew Jackson in the 1830s to Franklin Delano Roosevelt a century later. We can just, through abolition, through women's suffrage, through child labor laws, through arguments over income inequality and populism, through the fight for Black voting rights, this family is just laced through it. They're always politically active. They're always on the ground. The dad kind of starts out as a working class politician in Pennsylvania and raises his daughter in his kind of with his worldview. She's a daughter before suffrage, so she's not going to go vote. She's not going to be a politician, but he still kind of reads to her all the time and talks with her about politics all the time. And she grows up with this incredible political consciousness of trying to help working class people. And she has her own arc. I mean, she goes into socialism. She moves to Europe for a while and becomes friends with Engels, the famous Marxist. And she becomes really one of the most important anti-child labor activists in America, especially in Illinois, where she's in charge of monitoring the factories for child labor for a while. She's key for trying to clean up industry in America, especially in Illinois. So these two tell the story of this era. And I also liked them. You know, you want to write a book about people you like. And she's sharp and funny and in a kind of mean way. And he's passionate and really committed and brave. I mean, he survives attack it with a knife. He survives a riot where people are shooting at him. He kind of fights his whole life through. So I just, they became a way to talk about this long period.
And as we say, politics was passionate then. Party identification was the key form of identification for people. You talk about saloon democracy, which I thought was pretty interesting. You get to this next phase in your book, the second phase, which starts with the election of 1876. And that's one commonly known with the corrupt bargain. But you talked that there were other factors there that might have been a little more significant.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes in history, the thing we know about something that's kind of our anchor is not, at least to me, what's most important about it. So we know if people know of 1876 at all, they know that the winner of the popular vote eventually loses the Electoral College and does not get to become president. And there's a story told that there's basically a deal made, a corrupt bargain, in which Reconstruction, the effort to kind of defend Black rights in the South, will end if this candidate can get his seat, if Rutherford Hayes can be president. There's not much actual evidence to support this idea, even though it's in all the textbooks and in all the kind of undergraduate survey classes. What there is a ton of evidence for is that 1876 is the highest turnout election in American history. We know not everyone is eligible to vote back then, but people who weren't eligible were still marching in parades, arguing politics, wearing campaign buttons and novelties. There are all these accounts of like schoolgirls on the streetcars at the time arguing about the candidates. This is a big, loud democracy, and this is the peak of it. This is the biggest election. Everyone's turning out and engaging. Not everyone. Many people are turning out and engaging. And then the guy who wins the popular vote doesn't get to be president. It's like this stutter stop moment, almost like a mic drop. There's this building faith in democracy and engagement from Civil War on, this kind of pure democracy. And then you see how futile it can be and how silly it can be. And you get all these people marching in uniforms and in the street, and it doesn't actually mean a thing in the end. So it really is a turning point with how people question democracy, with how people question voting rights. And you see I hate to make all of history a decline, but this is a period where you see a decline in faith in democracy and ideas beginning to think about, like, well, who should we trust to vote? And a retraction from this idea that it's all progress and more people get the vote every year than the year before. So 1876, to me, the big thing is this popular engagement question.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is John Grinspan, who's the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, but it's called The Age of Acrimony: How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. To my listeners, this is really has a lot of relevance to today, and I'm going to ask John about that in a little bit. But this book is about an era, as I said at the beginning, that kind of is skipped over a lot, and featuring high turnouts in elections, an impeachment, two electoral winners without winning the popular vote, three assassinations. I mean, and you can kind of throw in the Gilded Age too. I mean, this is a really important era that's overlooked a lot, and that's why this book is so important. John's been going through a little bit of the book. As I mentioned, it's in three sections. I want to get into the last section and then talk about today a little bit. But the last one's called The New Weapons of Democracy, and it starts in the 1890s. And this is kind of in the middle of those rematches of Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison, which we've got a rematch now going on in our current race. But talk about that era and kind of what led to the factors that you maintain are still with us today to a degree.
Yeah, and you mentioned the rematch. To me, that's the argument for paying attention to this era, that not only do you have all these commonalities with statistics and turnout rate and kind of partisanship, 1892 election, which is not a very popular election, is the only other example we have of what's going on right now, where a president loses re-election, runs again 4 years later against the guy who beat him. This is Grover Cleveland, you know, isn't president for 4 years, runs again, and he wins. But if you want a parallel for all the frustrations we're feeling about seeing the same candidates running again 4 years later, that's I think that's the best one to point to. And it's The thing that happens is it takes a really long time for Americans to get bored and frustrated with their political system. That as long as it's partisan and as long as it's really heated and really social, it's pretty entertaining to turn out and want to fight the other guy. You know, you can go drink Democratic whiskey and campaign against the Republicans, or you can drink Republican beer and throw bricks at the Democrats. And voting, it's fun and it's engaging and it's the center of social life. So it's pretty hard to break people's like addiction to that horse race. But the longer that goes on, and honestly, candidly, the stupider it goes on, because it leads to real nonsense and violence and fraud, like actual fraud, not the idea that maybe there's fraud out there, but widespread voter fraud in election after election. People start to get tired of it. It takes a long time, but you get this reform movement who's trying to change democracy, and they don't agree on anything else. Some of these people are conservatives who are mad that working class people are playing a role in politics. Some of these people are socialists and labor activists who want to strengthen that role and see the parties as blocking it. But what they can agree on is that the current campaign culture is broken and isn't working and is preventing democracy. And they start over the late 1880s into the 1890s, really on the ground, building out the kind of reforms that ultimately change democracy. And they're not big, loud, you know, Supreme Court cases. They're not amendments giving the right to vote to a block of people. So they're easy to miss. The cultural changes that have to happen to get people to become less partisan, to vote based on issues as opposed to hating the other guy, to calm down. And that's really good. But at the same time, they make a trade and they kind of harm what was beneficial about their democracy at the same time.
Yeah, you talk about the secret ballot and the impact that had on the parties. And that really played a major role in kind of the decline of the strength of the parties to some degree.
Yeah, it's a perfect example. And it's the kind of thing where, not living in that era, trying to be objective, it's hard to say which was better. Because previously, the way you ran an election was there's almost no intervention from the government. That they set up basically a booth and a judge. And then to go vote, you go and party activists give you paper ballots that they've printed to put in a ballot box. So Republicans print Republican ballots, Democrats print Democratic ballots. Third parties can print ballots and get involved pretty easily, which is why there are more third parties back then. And you take it yourself. Government doesn't play a role and you vote in front of your community. This is if you're lucky enough to vote. If you're over 21, if you're male, in most places, if you're white, but African-American men did vote in large numbers. And that's how you do it. It's this community thing. It's this initiation. They called voting for the first time your virgin vote because it's like your introduction into manhood. And then they introduce a secret ballot where you vote in privacy. The ballot is printed and monitored by the government. And you vote by yourself. You're no longer in the community. You're no longer with your brothers and your uncles and your boss. And so on the one hand, maybe you are a better voter in that you do research, you vote really, you're conscious. There's no peer pressure. You can honestly vote. And that's a plus. But if it's not social, if people aren't drinking beer and singing songs and yelling slogans, you might not go. Like turnout, this is a period when turnout just crashes. You know, those high turnouts, 80% of eligible voters going to the polls in the 1880s and 90s. Within a generation, half of eligible voters stopped voting. And you have this huge trough. A third of people who could vote stopped participating in this key right in American life. Actually, as the ballot's expanding, as women get the right to vote in 1920, fewer people are bothering. They're just not as culturally engaged, even if they have the right. So they do make these elections cleaner, but they also make them quieter and duller. And for the last 100 years, we've been fighting to get people to turn out.
That's counterintuitive, but you make this point very well in the book. And the great phrase you use, we went from politics without government to government without politics.
Yeah. That wasn't me though. There's this guy, Henry Damaris Lloyd, who's an Illinois reformer actually in Winnetka, good. His books are 120, 30 years old, but he's so sharp. And he's this guy who can turn a phrase and started muckraking journalism. And yeah, politics without government, they're not doing much. They're not really making, Gilded Age policy is pretty small. The government's pretty small. And then they switch to government without politics. So you block out the people, especially honestly, working class people, less educated people, immigrants, younger people, African-Americans, they're voting less in the 20th century. But at the same time, you have all these progressive legislations being passed. You have all these reforms that really changed American life. And I guess the question is, what's the trade-off there? Is it better to have a big, loud, angry democracy where people are really paying attention? Or is it better to have something a little more quiet and a little more removed with more gatekeepers, but where they're passing laws and they're civil and they're not shooting each other? And honestly, I have no dog in that fight. They both, as a historian, I like to be able to say they're all bad, you know?
We talked earlier about how you said the 1876 race was misinterpreted. You also bookend that with the 1896 race, and this is the most misunderstood era of the American democracy. Talk about that 1896 race and your comment about this misunderstood era.
Yeah, I mean, I know this era is really obscure, but if anyone has heard of any of these elections, it's probably 1876 and 1896. People know 76 because of this bargain, which to me, there's not much evidence that it actually happened. There's a big change there, but there's no like secret deal that really we can prove in any way. And then 1896, we see it as this really exciting standing up. There's this guy, Williams Jennings Bryan, who finally gets the Democratic nomination. He's interested in income inequality. He's interested in kind of challenging the powers that be. And people love him because he's a great speaker. He's really motivating, comes from Illinois also. He honestly, he really gets his clock cleaned. He loses by a huge amount. And you see this realignment to the Republican Party. And you see a politics after that that's more corporate, more kind of removed from popular campaigners, more about money, more about printing education and people who are paid to work for the parties as opposed to people who are volunteering because they care or get something out of it. You really see it, honestly, a turning down of the volume in 1896. You see these new reforms quieting politics, and it's kind of the last big loud election. So I think the story people tell of it is actually the end of something, not the beginning of something.
John, let's, and again, for our listeners, I've just scratched the surface here with John on this book. There's a lot more, but from a time perspective, I just wanted to kind of close with a couple questions here. One is, you've talked a little bit about it, but what are the lessons for today? I mean, one of the things that I think most people right now, I talk to a lot of people that are very worried about the future of our democracy. We've been through this before, is your book, and what's your message to those folks?
You know, as a historian, when I hear the word lessons, I get worried because I don't know. You know, you study the past. It doesn't really, I'm sorry to say, it doesn't really predict the future. What I will say is I think since 2016, certainly 2020, there's been a sense among a lot of Americans that we are on a irreversible downward spiral. And the only thing that can happen is things get worse. And people sure felt that way in the Gilded Age. And they felt like their politics were descending, and there are tons of evidence of people saying democracy is a failure, it just doesn't work. And then a reform movement emerges that dramatically changes politics and cleans up a lot of the things that people used to previously see as proof of the failure. They don't clean up everything, they break as much as they fix, but they do deliberately decide to change their political system and succeed in making big change that affects our whole life today, or affects our political life today. So I think this idea that we're in this irreversible decline and civil war, and I think we're just pointing at one era in American history, and there's tons of examples in our history, this just being one of the most interesting ones, of reformers changing our society for the good or for in dramatic ways. And honestly, if they could do it then, we can do it now. The other last thing I'd say with that is a lot of these reforms start in the 1880s, 1890s, and don't show themselves in people's lives for 15, 20 years. A lot of the big changes you see structurally, and I think we know this from our own lives, it takes decades for them to really impact how people behave. So it's possible that there's a young generation of reformers now who are thinking these things through or have been for 10, 20 years. And in another decade, we might see the impact of it. I guess the key lesson of history is nothing's permanent. No direction is inevitable. Change is the only thing that's permanent. And so whatever our mood is now will probably be really different in a generation or so. And I think this history kind of proves that.
We can learn from it, but it's not necessarily determinative.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not locked in, and it's unpredictable and surprising too. No one in 1876 would guess what an election looked like in 1924. So the best we can do is kind of hold on and see and keep our mind open to the past, because we aren't living in this world that's so different from the world before us. We have to kind of remember that as we go forward, that we do have parallels. We do have precedents. They're not the same, but they're kind of instructive, as you say.
Yeah, and I'd say the late 1960s are another such era.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we could look at.
Yeah, I noticed.
I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say there's a thing I notice people do where we try to build a barrier with the past to make our own era the most extreme possible. And we say, sure, that happened. But now X, Y, and Z is happening. And believe me, I'm worried and upset about plenty of things, too. It's not like I sleep all that easy at night either. But that barrier is, I think, a form and way of arrogance, that our era is important and it's more important than the past. And when we open our minds to what happened in the Gilded Age or in the 1960s, we just learn more about the options in the world, honestly.
I got time for one last question. I wanted to just let you talk a little bit about a brand new book you've written. I've got about a minute and a half here. Just talk about this book and when it'll be out, and what led you to writing this.
Well, we're going to need a couple of hours, Robin. I don't think that's fair.
We'll come back. I'll have you back when I read it.
I would love to come back. There was this mass movement before the Civil War called the Wide Awakes. They were Northerners predominantly who were opposed to slavery controlling American democracy and started marching at night in military uniforms to protest slavery, support democracy, and elect Abe Lincoln. And on the one hand, it's this mass movement. It's one of the biggest movements in American history, certainly one of the most consequential because they helped bring the Civil War. And on the other hand, it's guys at night with torches and uniforms. And it's really scary to some people. They're huge in places like Iowa, like Illinois. They're really, you can find evidence of them all over the place. We've basically forgotten about them, but they helped elect Lincoln. They helped bring the Civil War. And when it comes time, they're the first ones who enlist to go fight. I mean, the first bloodshed of the Civil War in Baltimore and in St. Louis is Wide Awake related. These clubs turn into militias at some point. And watching that line between politics and violence is really interesting and instructive. So I'd love to come back and ramble on about them for a while.
I'll definitely have you. Thank you again for taking the time. Our guest today on Heartland Politics has been John Grinspan, who's the author of The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. Highly recommended, folks, if you get a chance, a lot of applications for today. Great history. And again, John, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It's great.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.